Coming up next on Tech News Today, Sam Skovish from Ars Technica joins me for the full episode. We talk about the continuing privacy saga of Mitu. Tidal might actually be fudging its subscriber numbers. Apple is suing Qualcomm for a whopping $1 billion. The Nintendo Switch hangover has officially begun. And the return of the Lawnmower Man. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1688, recorded Friday, January 20th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. I'm Jason Howell. I am not today. I'm looking at an empty seat right now. I look over and I see no one in this chair that you can't see because it's outside of the camera's view. But Megan Maroney is not here today or for the first few days of next week. So we're going to have kind of like a rotating co-host slot for the next few days. And it's going to be a lot of fun, starting with, you know him, you love him, Sam Skovish from Ars Technica. How's it going, Sam? What are you doing?
Sorry, I'm power leveling or something. I don't know. Whatever. I'm snapgramming.
Snapgramming. You're snapbooking. Excellent. Cool. I'm happy we brought you on because you obviously know the lingo.
Happy Friday to you from the hist guy you know, surely.
That's right. Yeah. Happy Friday indeed. We have things to talk about. They have things to do with technology. We're going to keep firmly locked into technology. There's a lot of other stuff going on in the world. We're going to try and keep it zeroed in on technology.
I can do that. And do that for at least 48 minutes, but by minute 49, I may crack. So you better rush with me here.
Let's get it. Let's get right to it. All right. First things first, Megan and I discussed the flavor of the week selfie app called Mitu on last night's show. It's kind of at the end of the show. I made a joke about it a little bit. And the permissions that the app calls for, which is a lot, by the way. Mitu developers actually issued a statement to CNET saying its headquarters, kind of clarifying some things, saying that its headquarters are in China, which we knew. As such, the company is required to implement alternative tracking methods thanks to Apple's App Store and Google's Google Play Store being blocked in that country. You can't get those app stores in China right now. So they have to do kind of alternative tracking measures for ads and for China, which has certain rules that they implement. Mitu developers say the data is secured with multi-layer encryption, advanced firewall protection, and they insist, they say, we promise we're not selling that data to anyone. Did you see anything about this Mitu app and, you know, automatically like install it and do a crazy selfie of yourself that is creepy and weird like that, although you don't need the app apparently?
Yeah, I feel like I'm really rosy and adorable already, so I'm pretty good to go. I will say, really bad with beards. It really doesn't understand the beard. So get to work on that, and I will give you my data, good sirs of Mitu. Yeah, I mean, it's garbage because it's just automatically taking some very simple face data and translating it in ways that is not hard for a geek to find on the internet. It is not hard to find automatic filters in free open source image manipulation programs. So I feel like anybody who went and downloaded this on something other than my firewalled extra burner phone, which I use for anything that has Chinese all over it, pardon me, just in terms of data transfer, I think ultimately, though, this is a good reminder that when you download something and it doesn't have any advertising in it and it's free, what's the product? Mm-hmm. You are.
That's
I think it's going to happen no matter what. Now, let's say they've encrypted and firewalled and PHP'd and whatever other buzzword they might want to throw out that doesn't mean anything, your data.
Right.
Doesn't matter. The whole point is they are taking your facial data, your location data, who you transfer to, who you send to, whatever cookie-ishness they can pick up on. Everything is useful. Everything can be advertised to. Everything can be sold off to someone else to develop the next thing. That's it. It's data as value. So it's you've just once again become part of that microcosm if you have MITUE'd your face, in my opinion.
Well, and I would venture to say that MITUE, this is true. MITUE is not the only app that you probably have installed on your phone that is doing something like this. There are a lot of apps that do this type of tracking. The difference here, of course, everybody latched onto the fact that, well, this is an app that suddenly everybody's getting, and it's sending that data, including Mac addresses, including IMEI numbers, for their own tracking purposes back to China. And so people freaked out about that. When they really kind of dug into it, it really seems like a lot of this is, you know, part of it is the requirement that China actually has. They have new rules as of August 1st of last year that require developers in that country to authenticate the identity of users, as well as tying online profiles to identifiable information pulled from, you know, when they install the app and everything. That's kind of cold comfort, right? You're still sending them that information. But I would argue that there are a lot of apps that, you know, free apps, like you say, that you may or may not have installed in your phone, but have at some time, that have done exactly this to developers, even here in the U.S.
Right. I found it very fascinating a couple months ago when a guy dug through permissions on the Facebook app just to see all of the different granular things. It knew when your battery was running out and sent that information to Facebook, all that sort of thing. I mean, goodness, my phone just told me that there's a taco place down the block that it wants me to review because Google's whole app network wants all that sort of information. So ultimately, I'm also really surprised because I saw the app blow up and I'm like, this thing is old. It's been on the Google Play Store, I believe, at least a year, just in the United States. Lord knows how long it had been there, even longer. You'd said it's been around longer.
It's been around 8 years, I think they said. Yeah. The app itself has been around for about 8 years.
But it's amazing what happens when there is that sort of viral push.
Yeah.
Like, at what point did Facebook and Twitter's algorithms look at, I don't know, 50 influential people and say, all right, this matters today. This is your distraction for the day. I find that fascinating. I would love to see someone really break down that data and sort of track out. And you might learn a lot about American social networks in seeing exactly how that went out to just users at large. Because by the end of yesterday, everybody I knew had a really rosy-cheeked, bulgy-eye Korean soap opera photo. Oh, I mean, it's just...
I'm staring into your soul right now, Sam.
I can't even pay money for that. You know, all that should be in Netflix's amazing Korean and Chinese soap opera catalog right there, that image. I would binge that.
I'm happy that I installed it, if only for that one photo. It's not on my phone anymore. Actually, it's not even my phone. It's Megan's phone. But I don't feel bad about it because she installed it on my phone because she has my Pixel. So.
Well, it does make sense that Megan would be 8 years late to some social media phenomenon. Ho!
Zing!
Hi, Megan.
Yeah, by the way, hello, Megan. Samsung has taken its time analyzing what led to a number of battery explosions with its now recalled and possibly a collector's item Note 7 smartphone. But Samsung appears to be ready to share its findings during a press conference this Sunday evening. It's actually Monday morning back at home, but here it's Sunday evening. But if you can't wait that long, a report from the Wall Street Journal reveals that the cause is related to, quote, irregularly sized batteries, as well as manufacturing inconsistencies. Samsung enlisted the help of three independent firms to analyze quality control, analyze the supply chain, really break it down. And it sounds like the report is going to be all about the fact. And by the way, this was floated very early on when the explosions started happening. It's like, well, maybe the batteries don't fit inside the casing. That was by many people at least implied as a potential reason why this was happening. So it sounds like that might actually be the case.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to add because they're not really saying a ton new.
Right.
I do wonder if the event will be a great opportunity for them to shout about whatever amazing thing they're going to give to people to make them love the company again. Because although Samsung's going to be fine, ultimately, people are going to still keep on buying these things and assume that the next one does not blow up. But it's that they have to, they got to come out with something because really all they did this past Christmas season was tell everyone, We got Gear VR headsets to give you. Here's a shot of 12 people really having fun watching grandma float around in VR. And even as an admitted junkie for VR, I was like, this is so stupid. You guys are, you really blew it. I feel like if they gave away their fancy pants, Internet of Things washers and dryers to everybody who dealt with this,
everybody
assuming those don't blow up, then,
yes.
then you know, maybe do, that would know. Make do.
Yeah, but, some
you know,
of them do.
I just don't – I don't get what else there is to say other than I am so happy that the FAA has told all of the flight attendants in America to stop telling us about that note warning, because I don't know anybody who got on a plane with one of those things and went, what?
Wait a minute. You're telling me what now?
You know,
hold the phone. Literally.
I got to give this to you. Like, yeah, that didn't happen. We're done. We're moving on. I'm happy.
Exactly. Well, and by the way, Samsung has its earnings early next week. I think it's Tuesday. And they've already come out and said that they're going to have really great, like record-breaking earnings for last quarter, even in light of the Note 7 debacle that happened, because they've got a strong chip business. A lot of their other business is really successful in offsetting any of the losses that happened in smartphones. As unbelievable as that may be, because this was a big deal for Samsung.
And this is going to be a great moment in terms of people curious about the very workings of Samsung. Because if they have this much stuff making money for them, keeping them afloat between chips for other devices and emerging markets, they're going to trumpet that stuff. They're going to make that loud. And I think that's going to be a really interesting thing when we look at the Samsung versus Apple kind of battle that we look at in general throughout, you know, for the past few years.
Yep. Absolutely. Press conference happens in South Korea Monday, January 23rd, 10 a.m. local time. So that's Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern. And we will, of course, talk about it all on Monday's episode. Probably won't be adding very much because I think we already kind of know what is going to be talked about. Tidal has claimed in the past that it currently has more than 3 million subscribers that pay to use the service. But a report out of Norway, a Norwegian paper, says the company has overreported its numbers on at least two separate occasions. In September 2014, Jay-Z, who actually owns the service now, tweeted 1 million users when, according to the report, the service actually had more like 830,000. Then, and this is kind of the bigger one, in a March 2016 press release, Tidal claimed to have 3 million subscribers, not including trial members, while reporting internally had it more around 1.2 million. But Tidal only really made payments to labels for around 850,000 subscribers. So, I mean, the numbers are all over the map. Ultimately, it doesn't seem like Tidal, well, it's hard to tell whether Tidal has its ish together, but it certainly isn't conveying that image. And I don't know how successful Tidal has been.
Although, did you just say tish like you were being remixed in a sweet Jay-Z track?
Kind of.
I appreciate that. I also appreciate that we go to Norway for our hot Jay-Z business news.
I did think that was a little weird. But hey, it was taking the news by storm. So there
well, you. It's clearly something we don't care about, which says a lot. I mean, how many times have you
Fair
heard
enough.
anybody anecdotally mention Tidal? No, I'm serious. Do you know anybody who's mentioned Tidal in the past, you know, 5 months?
In the real world? No, I don't. No. I did sign up for Tidal for 1 month this month because I reviewed it on one of my shows. But I listened to the hi-fi service and I was pretty impressed with the quality. But, you know, the catalog, and I don't know, there wasn't enough there. It's $20. So there you go.
I mean, I've been following sort of that snake oil sales of FLAC, F-L-A-C, which, you know, the higher bit rate stuff. And I love that sort of thing. I was interested in the Pono player that Neil Young put out a couple of years ago. I was interested in Tidal pushing that. And it's just, there's just so many parts of the ecosystem that all have to add up. It's like taking really nice coffee and putting it into one of those little Keurig reusable cups. It's just going to taste like garbage. That's the problem ultimately. And that's the same thing Apple's facing on the other end of the spectrum with their AirPods being so expensive that they're supposed to be a little bit nicer and have a little bit bass resonance. But, you know, it's the whole ecosystem. If you've then got, you know, crappy Spotify bitrate stuff with those ear pods, then you're missing out. So there's always something to that. But ultimately, Tidal has nothing in terms of true usability that it can really push, in my opinion. And you played with it a little more recently, so correct me if I'm wrong. But other than bitrate choices being right there front and center, the selection just isn't doing much. You know, it's ultimately every music system has pretty much every label on board because it's so easy for a label to just take their music and go whoosh Every service has the file. Every service gets a small cut. So that just really kills the ability to differentiate what you're giving. So unless you've got some magical Sonos or Google Play, or so, if you figure out something that really locks into some other ecosystem, then mm-hmm. you've got a shot. Tidal never found a way to do that. And it's I wonder how many of these 850,000 are people who just keep forgetting to cancel the thing.
Right.
Like, you got your free trial and then it keeps going. I always wonder about how much of that is. But the other thing I think of is there's not really good independent services reporting on true subscriber numbers. You can scour through different download measures and different store measurements of how top grossing and things like that. But for some of these subscription services, those numbers really do fly under the radar. Mm-hmm. We may know a lot about how many people are playing Pokemon Go and paying for it, but things like Tidal can fall through the cracks, and that really matters when you've got labels saying we ain't getting paid.
Right. Yeah. And actually, to that point, so it wasn't just a Norwegian paper that comes up with this report. I mean, they were the ones that were kind of distributing this initially. Arthur Sund, who is a former manager of business intelligence for Tidal, said that they have a history of deliberate misreporting. He said Tidal added 170,000 subs last October. Very suddenly, so probably to kind of make up for something, but they were all dead accounts. They were all zero activity, possibly lapsed, whatever the case may be, so probably tying right in with what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Good way to goose the numbers, I suppose.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, well, sorry, I could go on about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Tidal has tried to differentiate itself by means of that higher bitrate service. The problem is, the majority of people, I don't think, actually really care that much about that.
Now, and clearly the artists who did sign on and said, we're Tidal. We had Kanye, Arcade Fire. It's not hard to find those artists elsewhere.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not like that's not how you show your brand loyalty to a band. You buy their shirt. You don't use their app.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Apple filed a $1 billion lawsuit claiming that Qualcomm has charged royalties, quote, for technologies they have nothing to do with, end quote. Apple uses Qualcomm chips for its mobile devices, of course. Many mobile device manufacturers do. Earlier this week, the Federal Trade Commission also had filed a suit against Qualcomm over exclusionary tactics and how it licenses its patents. Apple says after years of disagreements, the company was forced to take the issue to the courts. And it really seems like Apple's kind of jumping on to kind of piggyback on the case that the FTC floated a little bit earlier. So I'll be very curious to see how much this grows, considering this one really bad week for Qualcomm started the way it did. And so many manufacturers work with Qualcomm in many ways. I could see this being a big piggyback thing for, with a lot of companies, possibly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The domino effect. Now, it's so funny with these reports, because ultimately you have to dig into so many patents, so many licenses, in terms of everybody having a claim to something like touching a screen to get a menu to pop up. You know, it's like, it's how Microsoft keeps making money off of every Android phone being sold and all that. But this mm-hmm. story, I hope I'm not cutting you off by mentioning this one, but Apple's saying that this is a bit of a blackmail thing. And that's why I think the story is really making the rounds, because Apple agreed with the Korea Fair Trade Commission in terms of giving a testimony that harmed Qualcomm, and Qualcomm, according to Apple, allegedly has withheld money that should be paid to Apple as a result.
Right.
You know, almost $1 billion is what they're saying. And that's, I mean, gosh, if that's true, how the heck did they think they were getting away with that? Like, I'm sorry, that doesn't slip between the couch cushions. That's a lot in terms of paying back for licenses and
billion
things.
$1 billion is nothing these days. I feel like
Apple's
that in the couch cushions at home.
Yeah, no, Apple's not going to make that statement if they don't have that in triplicate.
Yeah.
You know, that's you don't just say a billion and go, oh, actually, it's only like 800,000. No, that's probably a billion. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Apple, you're exactly right. $1 billion. Also insisting that Qualcomm is charging. Apple actually insists that Qualcomm is charging five times more than others of Apple's patent licensors all combined. So Qualcomm is just way up at the top of the list, way overcharging.
Of course, thing about that is who knows if that's Qualcomm really overcharging or Apple essentially getting their way, bouncing around like the big King Kong they are with everybody else. That yeah, I don't. True. I think that remains to be determined, and I don't see Qualcomm necessarily. Qualcomm may have a shot in terms of coming back and saying, "No, no, no. We have spent this much in R&D, and we have established this. This has a value." That we deserve that. Just because Apple's ripping everybody else off doesn't mean they rip us off. But yeah, that $1 billion blackmail thing, I think, is really going to be that's going to be the thing I think is going to be much harder for Qualcomm to fight off. So I look forward to seeing how they dance around that one.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And finally, Amazon is doubling down on the Dash. That's its push button system for quick one-tap purchasing of products from the e-commerce site that I've never had a single Dash. I don't have one in my house. They look neat, but I haven't felt the need. Amazon.com's homepage now and their app home screen are starting to show virtual versions of those buttons so you can make sure you never have to work very hard to refill your stock of toilet paper or whatever it is you buy a lot of via Amazon. Those buttons are actually going to be customized based on users' buying activity. Users can also create their own buttons by selecting the add to your Dash buttons dial on a product page when you visit it. So you can customize the Dash and your products will be one tap away. This is apparently pretty good for Amazon to make it easier and easier to buy things. That's what this is all about. Tell me you have a Dash, or maybe you have a room dedicated to Dash buttons. No?
Yeah, that's. I'm going to fill this whole little white spot on my
that's
wall.
That's what you need to do with that
Dash
spot.
Buttons for all the all things that are bad for me. I hate it. I yeah. hate everything Amazon does to make you buy a thing without thinking about it. I'm afraid to say the A word because I have the little voice activated guy over there. She will purchase things for you if you aren't careful. You get it like you get a yes or no to confirm whether you want to. But yeah, she who shall not be named absolutely drives commerce that way. The Dash buttons to me. If there was a Dash button that had a little LED screen that might update, that might have relevant things on it, that might, for example, give me discounts and list a price and some more useful information, that'd be fine. I also think here's where I think Amazon, I mean, this is terrifying, but I'm also kind of on board with it because it would be such an interesting science thing to do. If they had cameras that tracked what you did use in your house and then ordered things for you when they ran out as a result of that, because that is kind of what they're doing with their grocery store project in right. Seattle, which I tried to break into. They wouldn't let me in. I said, no, I'm cool. They said, you can't come in. But that it's all machine learning stuff where they're using all these different cameras and sensors to track what you're using. Now, I think, honestly, if you were going into your normal cabinet and getting some sort of disposable thing and it tracked that and even, for example, saw you're kind of low and she who shall not be named might go, hey, Sam, you're almost out of coffee filters. That could be this incredible, brilliant thing if that was combined with discounts. But ultimately, what Amazon wants to do is speed you up and have you not think about the total price ecosystem. I do live pretty close to a store. Other people do as well. Sometimes I'm cool with going to the store, and sometimes I'm really cool with Amazon having a guy show up in an hour. It just depends.
Man, what you are describing sounds so much worse to me, like having it automatically like track everything and no,
but I just think no. I like the idea that they soup that up so much and like give it away for free or something like that. Of course, then that's where they're using your information as data. But, you know,
for sure.
Anyway, I'm weird.
Physical Dash buttons, by the way, cost $4.99. If you really do want to make that room in your house that's dedicated to nothing but Dash buttons, then it's like, oh, I need that thing. There's the one. $4.99. That's all it costs to get in the door.
It costs money for me to buy more of their crap without
getting exactly. They
great,
get you coming in.
Great
they
proposition,
get you
Amazon. I'm on board. You no. Here, I'm holding up a different finger up here.
Excellent. Outside of the screen, I appreciate that. Up next, we're going to chat a little bit about just kind of a small selection, a sampling of Nintendo news and bits there. But first, let's take a minute to thank Grasshopper. They're the sponsor of this episode of Tech News Today. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system. It's actually designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but it requires no hardware purchase because you already have the hardware. It's your phone. It's the smartphone you already have. They have an iOS and an Android app that you can install. And with that app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone at your work number, essentially. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. And then you can also use your phone for your own personal stuff. And they're kind of siloed from each other. You get your individual numbers for different purposes on the same device. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. You simply select a toll-free or a local number. You can record a custom greeting, add multiple extensions for your business. All this stuff, I mean, this is the standard business stuff. And you can do all this through your smartphone with Grasshopper. Toll-free numbers are awesome, as you already know, for marketing and making your business sound even more professional. So that's maintained here. You can set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world and get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments if you prefer to manage them that way. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number on your device. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 per month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit, and we thank Grasshopper for their support of Tech News Today. All right, Sam, we have a Nintendo News trifecta. First, we've had a little bit of time to chew on the Nintendo Switch details. I was out last week. I'm assuming you spoke with Megan about this a little bit. How delicious is the Switch now that the announcement honeymoon is over and announcement hangover has begun?
I could go in so many directions with this, but let's kind of start by focusing on the first thing that I thought about after the announcement. There were two takeaways, both from my coworker Kyle Orland and from other games writers who I really respect. The first is it's an incredible handheld. In terms of gaming, there's just nothing like it. We're looking at a 6.2-inch phone, 720p resolution, that's not necessarily as pixel dense as some really nice smartphones, but that is quite a bit for high-speed gaming because we're getting 720p resolution at 60 frames a second for really good-looking 3D games. We're talking Zelda, Mario Kart, Splatoon, these franchises that are a mix of known and kind of super nerdy. They're running very nicely. You've got really good joysticks, really good buttons, good triggers. You've got motion sensing. You've got a touchscreen. You've got these extra little paddles that can just come off and double in this sort of funky two-player thing. They're a little small. They cramp your hands, but it is a really cool party trick that Nintendo's just throwing in for free. This absolutely trounces the 3DS, which was the last system Nintendo made. It trounces the Vita, which was the last quote-unquote great portable system in terms of being powerful and having game-style controls. I mean, there's no cell phone out there that has these sorts of buttons and joysticks that feels that good. So that's half of the equation. The other half, a really weak home system. You plug this thing into your television, and you are looking at sub Xbox One and PlayStation 4, that's for sure, barely better than the Nintendo Wii U. Huh. Now, when that system came out, people said, it's kind of wimpy. I don't know if it's going to hold up very well. So I think Nintendo has an opportunity to come out and tell people, portable. This is a portable system first, and it happens to play nice with your television. However, they are packing in this bundle that they're selling separately for about $100 of a dock, an HDMI cord, this extra bulky power cord, and this extra little Joy-Con handle thingy. So that's you can buy that separately for about $100. So Nintendo could have essentially dropped this thing down to $250, maybe even $200 if they were crazy, and said, you know what, by default, great portable system. If you want to pay an extra $50 to $80, we'll let you have the home kit as well. Start portable, go from there. And the reason I point this out is because the PlayStation, Xbox, and computers like Steam and all that stuff, they all essentially play the same games. If you've got one, they all have sort of the same games with a certain exclusives from Microsoft and from Sony and stuff like that. It mostly comes down to, which system am I going to buy this for? But the Nintendo Switch kind of offers this proposition of, hey, we're going to be the only one that lets you take it on the go and have it essentially look as good, only, you know, with downscaled to 720p, not necessarily the best battery life, about 2.5 to 3 hours for 3D games. But I think that would be a chance for them to differentiate. Instead, Nintendo's making shouting it out. This is a home system that you can take on the go. And I feel like that messaging and that pricing is going to bite them in the butt if people look at it as a home system. It's a crappy home system. I've said it. It's an amazing portable system. And that's how I plan on using it. I pre-ordered it because I see that and I'm really excited about it. But there was a developer of the series Borderlands. They're called Gearbox Software. And they came out and they said, we thought about our next Borderlands game, Borderlands 3, being for the Switch. Nintendo's not partnering with us. And what that means is Nintendo is not helping developers take these newish games and downsample and make them work on the Switch. And I really think that could be easy. You lower the resolution, you lower a couple effects, you have these great buttons, and you've got yourself a portable that should be playing newer games. But their online network is not ready for launch. That may not come out until the summer, which is going to require this separate app. And I think that's going to really bite them in the butt, not helping developers with optimizing for a smaller screen, not helping developers with online network stuff. So that to me is what's making me most anxious about a handheld system that is really impressive looking otherwise. So that's sort of the first point in terms of all the stuff I've been looking at about the Nintendo Switch.
Why would Nintendo, if it's such a strong portable and such a weak console, why would Nintendo like take the gamble with marketing it almost equally for both? Because I mean, what you're saying sounds pretty right based on kind of the hunches that I've had in seeing coverage and seeing gameplay and everything like that. It does seem like a stronger portable device than it does a console. Why would Nintendo take that gamble?
Because they are terrified of losing the family dollar. The family that says, I want to plug Mario and I want to plug Zelda into my television and get that. Yeah. The problem is, though, they didn't make a system that's going to make that really compelling. And there's just not enough people, in my opinion, who are going to come out in that sort of casual way and get a home system like that for kids, except for rich people with brats. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get the Wii U for your kid right now, and there's Zelda and Mario stuff on there, and it works fine. I just think it's a failed assessment of how people play. And I think it's a failed assessment of how many people are going to reject the home nature by default. I do love the idea of being able to plug it in the TV in a pinch. I just kind of wish I could plug in an HDMI cord and have it. It might actually run worse without it being docked. The idea is that when you plug the dock in, that it's got power, and so it's overclocking a little bit and running a little faster. But I would honestly take a crappy looking signal just to be able to take a single cable and plug it super simply into my television. Right. But Nintendo's not even seeming to offer that. You're going to need this dock. And that would mean if you want to take this to a friend's house, plug it into their TV, you're going to have to take the dock with you in your bag. And I think that's kind of a blown design decision as well.
Right. Interesting. Well, how about we talk a bit about one of my favorite gaming themes, because I'm a nut for retro gaming, apparently, because I can't grow up. And that's the NES Classic. How much, like, it had a hot holiday season, obviously, still kind of hard to get, appearing here and there. How much of a hit has it been, do you think?
Well, there were some super nerds over at my favorite site, NeoGAF, which is just an incredible resource of hardcore gamers going through these sorts of things and reading between the lines and finding data. And they figured out that in the United States and Japan, just those regions, in November and December, the NES Classic and Famicom Mini, that's the Japanese version, combined to sell about 980,000 units. That's an estimate based on numbers that have been revealed. They mentioned numbers for certain months and percentages based on those and all that. But they're looking at about 420,000 sold in the United States since launch until the end of December, and 567,000 in Japan. The United States, being a much larger market, actually got the shrift in terms of stock for that initial run. And this is missing the rest of the world. So Europe and other territories that have gotten NES Classics in their own have that there could be even more numbers on top of that. But what's interesting is they've had essentially a real struggle selling enough of these. And yet, Nintendo says they're going to have 2 million Nintendo Switch systems sold by the end of March. Something tells me that when they were doing this NES Classic, they were just trying with whatever production facility space they had to just crank something out just so that November and December wouldn't be terrible. And it turned out to be a lot more popular than I guess they projected, because I would assume if they've got 2 million of something going to sell in 1 month and they could barely make a million for 2 months for the other guy, that they really, really focus their manufacturing on the Switch in order to offset some of the sellout madness. And I will say, it was a lot easier for me to pre-order a Nintendo Switch. I had a span of about 45 minutes after the announcement at Amazon to grab a Nintendo Switch versus 10 milliseconds for the NES Classic. So I do think Nintendo, if either responded or simply was already preparing for this, to have enough out there so that if you knew in advance when it was being announced, that you could put your money down and get that $300 Switch. So seems like they've learned a lesson. I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to see the NES, or the Super NES Classic right around holiday time again? Is that, I mean, they're going to do that at some point, right?
I believe that they're going to do that, just in terms of this is such a Nintendo thing to take a closed product that you can't connect to the internet, that has a certain number of games, that cashes in a nostalgia. It's a very Nintendo thing to release. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. Hackers cracked the NES Classic pretty quickly and figured out how you just connect it with a little micro USB cable and tell it what games you want, and boop, you can add a bunch more games to it. And it's proving to be quite a good emulator all in all. Now, the diehards are saying that there's some lagginess to the button pressing and some of that stuff. But all that being said, I do see more of these little classic systems coming, and I do see them taking too long to come to market. Perhaps 2 years for a Super Nintendo. Who knows how long for a Game Boy kind of little guy. But, yeah. You know, I think the market has shouted and said, yeah, let's bring it on. Give me that $60. Give me that cheap little cute box. Do it in limited supply. We'll all go crazy about it. It'll be our, you know, Cabbage Patch Kids for next Christmas.
Or get yourself a Raspberry Pi 3 and hey, you've got everything you need. Finally, I didn't just say that. Finally, Nintendo says the Super Mario Run will finally get its Android release. Wait for it. No, really, you will have to wait for it because it isn't coming until March, another 2 months or so from now. But its next big mobile game, Fire Emblem Heroes, will fill in that void by hitting iOS and Android on February 2nd. First with Run, will do you think any remaining madness be around at that time? I mean, I feel like at this point the madness has kind of faded, but I guess Android users haven't had their shot at it yet.
Android users have not had their shot, and there are a lot of Android users in a lot of developing countries. It's going to be very easy for Nintendo to hit the button and access a lot of people in certain countries that, for whatever reason, may not have. Nintendo releases their consoles at very different stages at different times in different regions. And I think you're going to see China and India absolutely buy, maybe not enough to make it worth, you know, the sales have been pretty low for Super Mario Run because people are downloading but not paying that full $10.
Right.
And that may keep up with some of those developing regions in terms of how they spend money. But I think it will absolutely jump to the top of the charts. They have a pre-registration thing in Google Play's store, and I signed up for it. I know everybody's going to get that bloop. They're going to download it immediately. It's going to be at the top of the download charts that first day and perhaps that first week. But as we've seen with iOS, once you've gotten your taste, that's really it. And Nintendo has not put stuff into the app to make it really seem apparent that they are building this as a living platform with more levels or more options or things that might really add value to it. It's a short game. The value's sort of been set. And yeah, the fever, all in all, is gone for the people who got it. We're just going to add some more people who can get bored with it really fast.
Yeah, right. So tell me a little bit about Fire Emblem, because this is the next kind of, and we've been hearing about this for a while, that this was going to come to mobile, Fire Emblem Heroes. I don't know very much about this this particular property. What can you tell me about it?
Well, that was exactly why Super Mario Run came out first, because Nintendo sort of looked at everything they had, saw how fast Super Mario Run was being finished, and said, you know what? We're going to get a lot of attention, and that's going to make people pay more attention to Fire Emblem, which has been more of a diehard series. Launched in Japan before it ever came to the United States. It only came to the U.S. after fans downloaded it illegally off of the internet and translated it themselves and realized this is a pretty cool tactical RPG game, as in players take turns moving their little characters across a grid-based map and battle each other. Seems like a perfect thing for a touchscreen phone where you can just tap your finger on a dude, choose how to move them sort of chess piece style, and assign attacks. So Fire Emblem Heroes is funky because it is considered a gacha game. Not as in got ya, although it kind of is. These are games where the economy is all about
unlocking random characters. And Fire Emblem as a series has existed for so long, has so many games, that there's tons of these little characters. So you get the game for free, and you can unlock a few heroes at first for free, but you're going to want to customize and make your armies more powerful as the challenges get harder. Enter the microtransaction system, where you can either earn or pay for little orbs. You spend the orbs in order to create new heroes. The heroes you create are based on the colors of orbs that you spend. They're like red, green, blue, purple, this sort of thing. And after you spend your orbs, the hero that appears is random. It might not be as good a hero as you want. And that's when the game says, hey, you can spend one orb less to generate another hero. Okay, do that again. We could do another discount, and it just wants you to buy five in a row for this sort of, you know, buy five to save the most thing.
Shoot me now,
oh,
Sam.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Like, that's the thing that I think is going to drive people nuts once they get into it, because it is the kind of game that has a lot of characters and has that opportunity for, if I just buy another little dude right now, then I can get the discount on getting the perfect army, and then I can beat a few challenges, and then the game will throw more challenges at you later where you totally need brand new heroes, so you start that process over. The thing that bums me out about this game, as it stands, is it is a shrunk-down version. I can't believe Nintendo did this. They make the maps in these games normally very large, and they said for this one, no, the grid is going to be 8x6. That's less than a chessboard. And the reason is because they want everything to fit on one screen, as if people can't just swipe with more, you know, two fingers in order to move a map around. I think it's ridiculous. It's a really shrunken down thing that I think is going to emphasize this whole economy thing, as opposed to that feeling of, oh, this is like the old games that are beloved because they are tactical, because they offer you that real feeling of being a general, but in a cutesy way. I think that really blows it. And I think they can redeem themselves by adding a two-player mode where two people holding phones next to each other could battle each other. Mm-hmm. That's not in this game. I would love to see Nintendo add that. That would totally mix the script up. I would totally spend money on that version, I will say. I will not lie.
I entered this segment excited about anything that Nintendo puts out on mobile, and I'm leaving it a little bit deflated because that just kind of sounds like an in-app purchase nightmare that I don't want to be involved with. Thanks a lot, Sam. I really appreciate it.
Happy to help, as ever.
Let's move into some feedback here. Tate, a Microsoft employee, wrote into TNT at twit.tv with some thoughts on distracted driving solutions. We've been talking about this the last couple of days. Tate said, phones may not be the real culprit or worst offender of distracted driving. And he includes a link to a CNET article, which has a study from 2010 that said that phones aren't the issue. It's general distraction while driving is. That research said that collision rates didn't change after bans of cell phone use were implemented as compared to states without those bans. And instead, the report encourages hands-free uses says that many times hands-free use is encouraged, but even that is just as dangerous. Like, it still kind of triggers and uses your brain in the same kind of distracted sort of way. So that maybe focusing on the phones isn't the issue. Maybe it's just focusing on not being distracted in any way as relates to phones is probably the best way to go. He also continued saying, I think the machine learning solution of focusing on positive reinforcement and reminders to drivers when a camera can tell that the driver is not paying attention is a great solution. Of course, I would want an opt-in choice for this kind of technology, but some might argue it could be mandated with a law. And he links to, of course, this is why he pointed out he was a Microsoft employee, links to a Microsoft study that uses Microsoft cognitive services to detect things like emotion, alertness, the environment that surrounds you, and it, all in an effort to alert drivers when it realizes it's necessary, when it realizes that a driver is distracted and that sort of stuff. What do you think? Is technology going to save us from being distracted, or is it just part of the problem?
I mean, my beef with some of these tracking services that are coming out is that they don't offer enough benefit in terms of cost for the users. I feel like they do a lot of spying and they don't really do a good job of offering a true 100% discount. And when you do it like that, it's like, oh, great. Now you're spying on me and I'm only getting $3. Like, no. Make it something that truly rewards and can give you that data and connect you in some way to that. I think that makes more sense if you're a parent and you've got a kid and you just want to go, listen, we're going to save your insurance costs a lot of money. So we're going to track you in order to save money. And I think as a kid, I'd be like, well, that's really stinks, but you know, I'm getting this for free. So why not? That's really the only use case where I see being spied on while driving really makes mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. Now I will say I'm really good at ordering pizzas while I drive. I'm really masterful at it. So I don't know what everybody else is going on about, but also I'm always shocked that there aren't more car dash systems that just lets you take your phone and just stick it in where the CD player might be. Like, I don't understand why somebody hasn't come up with that as a as seen on TV late night infomercial thing where it's a little kit with either micro USB or the Thunder or the Apple port or whatever else, and just make it like that. Because if that's going to be there anyway, just put the phone there. It changes the way you use it. It reduces your ability to grab. It makes you talk to it more. I think that's different than having like even a car mount like a lot of Uber drivers do. That's just my own two cents. That's me saying my grind my gears thing. I would love that. And if anyone wants to steal that idea, patent it, and get rich, just send me a free one, please.
Yeah, people kind of do this. Like you're saying, it is a little bit different than the car mount thing. But sometimes, like, I have a car mount and it's suctioned to the window. So it's still this thing that's above everything else. And, you know, it's still my phone in this thing, but sometimes they have it like attached to their AC vent or whatever that kind of brings it down and into the dash a little bit more. I can see what you're saying though. If it was like this nice, elegant, like drop it in, snaps into place. I just think that's really hard to do because there's so much variability between all these different
devices.
Not
a dreamer. You need to be a dreamer. Also, I like that you mentioned the suction thing because it reminds me of those old Garfield cat ones. Remember when everybody had one of these?
Yes, that's, I do remember those.
The show.
I remember those. Maybe that were they rampant in Seattle, I fear.
Oh, that was back in Texas. It was they were all like this, but they had guns in one of the hands.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah. All right. Yeah. TNT's fan of the day is Mike Yakovlev in Twitter, who sent us this. It's a little disturbing. Mashup of Megan and I. It's disturbing. It's intriguing. All at the same time, because it's actually strangely convincing. It's almost like I've got like 80s hair or something, or Megan's got 80s hair. I'm not really quite sure.
You know, it would really seal the deal on that one. A little side ponytail on your side. I think that would have been really nice. Neon blue. I think that really, really sealed the deal.
Oh, yeah. Hot. Well, Mike is a freelance artist, so I'm assuming he used his skills to come up with whatever that is that frightens me to my core. But I appreciate it nonetheless. Thanks for sending it in and getting creative. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or us and mash it together. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. That was Facebook, not Facebook. I don't know what that is. Use the hashtag How I Watch TNT and we'll find it. So finally, we're going to end with another one of Sam's stories here, but it kind of reminded me of being younger. One of the earliest visions of virtual reality that I can remember celebrating when I was younger was a little film called The Lawnmower Man. I would guess that the film doesn't hold up at all. It debuted in 1992. It's full of tight-fitting jeans and mullets. But back then, I don't know. When I saw the movie, I think I was working at a movie theater at the time. And so, like, I got to walk in there whenever I wanted. I just love the idea of throwing on a VR helmet, escaping the world, hopping into that big aero-trimmed gyroscope thingy that, by the way, has not been, you know, made its way to this whole VR renaissance that we're actively in right now as a thing that you can buy. But Sam, you wrote about the future of the Lawnmower Man. Apparently we've got more Lawnmower Man to look forward to. What is that?
By the way, I feel like this same pose I was doing earlier is the same one as being stuck in the VR rig of the Lawnmower Man. So yes. I'm gonna stick with it.
Yeah, no, something like that, right?
Something like that. So yeah, there's a 360 degree film company called Jaunt, and they were big at Sundance last year. They've returned to the Sundance Film Festival this year, and they announced a slate of upcoming projects, a bunch of stuff that is brand new, that's based on projects or that other people brought on original properties. The only one that has a familiar name is The Lawnmower Man. Well, and let's not forget, the name The Lawnmower Man was so unloved by its original creator, Stephen King, when he saw the movie that eventually came out, that he sued to have his name taken off of that film. And yet someone else was like, yeah, we got to make a VR movie out of this. That movie was about a guy like writhing around naked on his lawn. The short story that he wrote. And then the film became, you know, Pierce Brosnan, white shorts, training chimpanzees with VR helmets to become cyber warriors. A weird sexual assault scene where a dude becomes like a weird lotus fly thing and penetrates a woman's soul. It's just so creepy. So I'm absolutely excited that the movie's going to come out in VR. My beef is that Jaunt makes 360-degree videos, which is not the same as VR. Even the Lawnmower Man sort of understood that hands and presence were important things for selling its weird polygonal cyberpunk future crap. So what I would love to see is Jaunt take advantage of the fact that the original movie looked so bad, because that crappy low polygon stuff might render well on a little phone. If it would let you use your hands or kind of walk around or feel more in the scene, that might be fun and might be worth the payoff. But ultimately, the movie was very anti-virtual reality. So I'm kind of confused as to how meta it's going to get if they're trying to encourage you, hey, be excited by VR by putting on a helmet and then being told how terrible VR is. So I'll be curious to see how they twist that around. Of course, the thing we all have to remember, this is just the handlers announcing that the project exists. We don't have a producer. We don't have a director. We don't have actors. We don't have any chimps. You know, it's currently very minimal in terms of whether or how this is going to exist. But I will keep my eyes out, because Lord knows I want to be at that press screening, which I assume is just going to be a bunch of really bad smelling dudes all wearing headsets and like shouting, being able to barely hear each other in their own cyber hells.
Yeah, just an immersive viewing experience as opposed to an interactive. Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
God, I like how we started the show saying the future's terrible, and now we're ending the show remembering that a different kind of terrible may be coming our way.
Yes, we've come full circle. By the way, before we close things out, anyone who wants to get a Garfield window mount, I just put a link in the doc. Sorry to throw this to you real quick here, Anthony, right underneath the kicker link that we just talked about. But you can get one on eBay, of course. A vintage Garfield window suction cup plush thingy.
Yes.
That's what you're talking about, right?
Oh,
I remember those.
Oh, it's so authentic.
Takes you back to the 80s or 90s. Well, this
There's
is 80s,
hope
81.
For the future after all. I appreciate how this ended.
Exactly.
I will go gently into that good night.
We'll end on a positive note. It's only going to set you back like $12 with shipping, I'm guessing, so you should get one.
Into it.
Sam Iskovich from Ars Technica. We always love getting you on the show, especially when we can get you on for longer than 10 minutes for a segment. Thanks for joining me for the full episode today.
Happy to be here. I will see you guys next week. I will be talking about a very scary game that I just am playing right now. Resident Evil 7 is currently scaring the crap out of me.
Really?
And I almost mean it literally. It is starting very strong. Whether it turns out that well or not, you'll have to wait.
But I have to know, what are you playing it on? What is it on?
A giant OLED television that has HDR, and it looks real good in HDR. So, I mean, if you have $2,000 to spend, kids.
That sounds nice. Wasn't Resident Evil supposed to also be a VR title at one point?
I have the VR kit as well. We'll talk. Listen.
These are all things I need to know now, Sam.
Due time, fanboy.
Okay. All right. Fine. Appreciate your time, Sam. Have a great night and a great weekend.
Yes. See you guys soon.
All right. Take care, sir. Monday's guest joining me in Megan's absence will be the return of Russ Pitts. I always love getting Russ on the show, so it'll be great to catch up with him. Then, that's Monday. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, midnight, UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW, and find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsToday TV. Twit fans, we want to hear from you. We have a survey going on right now. It's an audience survey. It should only take about 2 minutes to finish. The survey basically helps us get a general idea. We do this every year, who our audience is, so that we can give you better programming, basically. It helps us pick advertisers we think you'd be interested in, all sorts of stuff. You tell us about the content, about how we're doing. Many of you take privacy very seriously. We promise always to protect that. We do not identify you in any way in the survey, so don't worry about that. Well, if you want to help us out, though, head over to twit.tv/survey right now. And you can find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony. Thanks to Mario for helping out here in the studio. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. Have a great weekend. We'll see you all on Monday. Bye, everybody.